Well, as you've heard, this is going to be a presentation about this Go versus IBM case and the implications of that. It's not really so much of a debate about the case, because I think we've all got pretty much the same opinion about it here. And there's not even really an argument that it's done SCO any good, I don't think. I think it's pretty obvious that it's backfired on them, and things aren't going to get better for SCO. They're going to get worse by the time the case is actually heard, because they're going to lose. But that doesn't mean that there isn't some point that they've got, in the sense that they've drawn attention to how open source development doesn't really take a lot of account, or maybe enough account, of intellectual property rights that might exist. And so if we're getting anything out of this Go case, it's going to be just reaffirming the importance of looking at the legal issues and being aware of them, and trying to structure your open source development model in a way that fits within the law of intellectual property. So what I'm going to do firstly is I'm going to spend a bit of time running through the actual factual background of the case, and I know a lot of people here will already be familiar with that, so if you can just bear with me if you are a full bottle on that, because I'll just be running through that first. So after that, I'll then look at a bit of background on intellectual property law, and then I'll put the two together and say, look, what are the implications of the SCO case in the light of the law, and what can we do to improve the open source development processes to make sure that we don't fall into the same trap. So beginning with that history, I think actually we have started it about 30 seconds early, so no worries if you're still making your way in, that's fine. Beginning with a bit of history, okay, who are the players in this game? Well, the emergence of SCO as the great Satan in this saga has come as a bit of a surprise to some people, particularly because SCO, of course, used to be Caldera Linux systems, and now the greatest threat to the open source community that we've ever had has come from someone who used to be part of that community, a Linux developer. The way that that happened was that the former Caldera systems purchased the Unix business of the original SCO, and SCO, of course, was a Unix vendor that had a Unix variant for the SME market called OpenServer, and it had one for a higher-end Unix called UnixWare. And SCO, well, the new SCO purchased those from the old SCO, and it also purchased, more importantly, the intellectual property rights that went along with those operating systems. And those intellectual property rights are a package that can be traced back to AT&T, who was the original owner, or one of the original main developers of Unix years and years ago. What AT&T did was they sold that package of rights onto Novell, and then Novell sold it onto Caldera Systems, which became the new SCO group. So that is how SCO and AT&T fit in. IBM has got its own Unix variant called AIX, and that is why IBM has had to enter into license agreements with SCO, or originally with AT&T, because its AIX operating system is based on the original Unix sources, and so SCO has a couple of contracts that it has the benefit of that it can use against IBM, and that's what the case is really all about. So where are we in this case? Well, we're still at an early stage. The litigation only commenced on the 6th of March 2003 when SCO filed a complaint in the Utah State Court suing IBM originally for $1 billion, but then they said, oh, what the heck, let's make it $3 billion. And it's not going to be until more than 2 years later on the 11th of April 2005 that we're actually going to have the trial. So in the meantime, of course, in between those two dates, there's a hell of a lot of uncertainty for the Linux community. And some people say that that's really what SCO is all about. They're really... For something of this size, yeah, it's not unusual. Even in Australia, it's not that unusual. But more so in America. But in the meantime, of course, there's this huge amount of uncertainty, and that is really possibly what SCO is wanting, because that gives them the opportunity to get their stock price up and to extract some license agreements from users and that sort of thing. If we are going to look into our crystal ball 2 years in the future, I don't think there can be too much doubt that SCO is going to eventually fail, and I think For one thing, there's no real evidence that there is any Unix code that has made its way into Linux. The most that we've got is really a couple of PowerPoint slides that SCO's CEO, Dahl McBride, presented at the SCO Forum last year. And one of those PowerPoint slides didn't actually show any Unix System 5 code. It showed some pre-existing BSD code that later made its way into System 5 and into Linux. And then the other PowerPoint slide that he showed had some old pre-System 5 Unix code that, if it wasn't already public domain at that stage, initially, it was public domain in 2002 because SCO actually published it on the web freely. So all that we've seen is a couple of slides that don't show any proprietary code of SCO's. Even if there is proprietary SCO code in Linux, there's a good argument that it's not proprietary anymore because SCO has been, as I've said, a participant in the open source community when it was Caldera Systems, and it was publishing this code on the under the GPL, and the source code was available to download from its website. So the argument there is that even if there was any SCO, proprietary SCO code in the Linux kernel, it has itself put it onto the into the open source community. And its response to that argument is, well, that was a mistake. We didn't need to do that. And whether that's actually a legal defense or not is something that I guess the case will be looking into, but oops is not really a legal defense. So regardless of the dubious legal strength of its case, SCO is making as much mileage as it can out of just the fear, uncertainty and doubt that it's generating. And so, you know, like I've shown here, on the 12th of May, it wrote a letter to 1,500 of its customers just warning them about not only their use of the Linux kernel, but also other open source software. And then they wrote another more specific letter just a while ago on the 19th of December to a few hundred of its customers, notifying them not only of the initial problems, but there's some new header files that SCO has found that have supposedly been taken from BSD that they're complaining about as well. And on the 19th of November, SCO released a statement saying that it was going to actually broaden its legal onslaught to include users of this BSD code during the first half of 2004. But Linux and BSD-based operating systems aren't the only ones in SCO's firing line, because they also said back in June, they hinted that they might have the right to take action against publishers of other operating systems. Other operating systems, including Mac OS and Windows, because those were originally derived from Unix. Although last time I checked, Windows was still on sale. So you've got to wonder whether SCO's bark is worse than its bite here, because it's making so many bizarre threats and claims, and it hasn't really followed through on any of them. On the 19th of November, it claimed it was about to sue one major Linux customer for copyright infringement. And there's been some speculation that might have been Google, but nothing has actually happened so far. It's also made threats against some of its other competitors, including Novell. Novell, as you may know, is acquiring SUSE Linux, and that has been blocked or threatened to be blocked by SCO on the grounds that that's in contravention of a non-compete agreement between SCO and Novell. Anyway, but again, nothing's happened so far. So SCO has been making lots of noise, but on the other hand, its competitors haven't actually been completely silent. They've begun to hit back. On the 4th of August, as I've got up here, Red Hat sued for a declaration that there was no copyright infringement in Red Hat Linux from any SCO source code. And there's also been a countersuit from IBM a couple of days later. And IBM and Hewlett-Packard have also taken the initiative of offering a limited indemnity to Linux users against claims of intellectual property infringement by SCO. So there's been people haven't taken it lying down. I mean, there is a bit of a defence going on there. So where are we now in the litigation process? Well, the most recent development was where IBM obtained a court order on the 5th of December requiring SCO to produce the code that it says is infringing by the 11th of January. Now, you may have noticed that the 11th of January was about 4 days ago. We don't actually... Supposedly, they've mostly complied. We haven't seen what they've complied, the documents that they've produced. Hopefully, we will see those on the 23rd of January 2004. So that's not too long to wait. But that's where we are at the moment. Meanwhile, Australia hasn't been completely immune from the effects of the litigation. What we have had in Australia is Kieran O'Shaughnessy, who's the local head of SCO, is currently, this very week, he's in London finalising the terms on which they're going to offer licences to Linux users for SCO's supposed intellectual property. Just as a ballpark, in the United States, the amounts they're asking are about $900 per server and about $250 as Australian dollars per desktop. So he's probably going to be coming back to Australia, and you can't actually buy a licence now if you wanted to, so which is very strange. But hopefully, well, not hopefully, but when he comes back from London, that's going to be coming in place in Australia pretty soon. Also, Open Source Victoria, as I've said there, have made a complaint to the ACCC about SCO's conduct. That hasn't actually resulted in a formal investigation yet, but that will be interesting to see what happens. So that's pretty much the state of play. So if we can just backtrack a little now and look at exactly what it is that SCO is claiming that IBM has done. Basically, SCO is claiming that IBM has used either the Unix source code or else its knowledge about Unix that it's developed in working on the source code. It's used that in Linux, and in doing so, it has breached its contracts with SCO. Because remember how IBM and SCO have got a contract because IBM has licensed Unix for use in AIX. So that's what's basically being claimed against IBM. And the PowerPoint slides notwithstanding, it's not just the little bits of code that have been cut and pasted that SCO is complaining about. SCO is also saying that IBM has, you know, used the knowledge and expertise that it obtained from the Unix kernel sources in developing similar technologies for Linux. And some of these technologies, the ones I've listed up there, we've got scalability and performance and scheduling improvements, a journaling file system, which is JFS, volume management, clustering, 32-bit and 64-bit support, stuff like that. Now, many of these weren't actually part of the original Unix codes that IBM licensed, but were developed subsequently. And some of them, in fact, were even developed by IBM subsequently, such as JFS, which is the journaling file system, the IBM journaling file system. And so SCO's argument there is that it can still prevent IBM from introducing these technologies into Linux because they're works that were derived from the Unix source code, even if they weren't part of it when IBM licensed it from SCO. And so SCO's saying that IBM's breaches of contract entitle SCO to terminate IBM's license for AIX. And in fact, SCO says that it has terminated the license. It claimed to have done that on the 16th of June 2003, which IBM, of course, denies. But frankly, the contractual part of this dispute is of less interest to us because the contracts between the two of them are complex and they don't really relate to the rest of us out here in the community. What we're more interested in is whether IBM has actually breached any intellectual property rights in Unix, regardless of contract. So has IBM actually breached any copyright? Has IBM breached any patents or trade secrets? That's more of more general application to the open source community. And in SCO's original court complaint, SCO did actually say that IBM had breached SCO's intellectual property rights in Unix, independently of the contracts. But that part of SCO's claim was thrown into doubt because Novell came up with a document that it said, look, we never actually gave you any copyrights over Unix, and then SCO came back with an amendment to that contract from 1996 saying, yes, you did, look, you amended this, you gave us... So there's a dispute over whether there is actually any copyright that SCO owns over Unix source code, and there's a question mark over how many patents it's got, because there were some original patents that probably were part of this package of rights that SCO purchased, but most of them have expired, and some of the others aren't actually in SCO's name, they're in other people's names, so there's a question mark over that, and as a result, we're not going to necessarily get a clear answer from the SCO versus IBM case as to whether there's been a breach of intellectual property rights. We're just going to get an answer about whether IBM has breached its contract with SCO, which, like I say, is less interesting. But but it is important for us to look at the intellectual property rights question because of the fact that SCO has been making threats against other people in the community. Like, if it does go and sue Google or someone like that, it's not going to be because of any contract between SCO and Google. It's going to be because of copyright or patents or something like that. So that's why it's still important for us to look at those things. So I'm going to just give you a brief rundown on intellectual property law. And intellectual property rights fall into a number of categories, which are most importantly copyright, patents, and trade secrets. Also trademarks, that's not so important though. So copyright is the most obvious form of protection of computer software, and it's probably the easiest one to not accidentally infringe, because it really does involve copying word for word pretty much, or making an adaptation of something, and you can't easily do it accidentally. So the fact that Linux may work in much the same way as Unix, which it does, I mean that's the whole point, that in itself isn't a ground of complaint under copyright law for SCO. It can't do anything about that. If anything, it can complain about that under patent law or something else, but not under copyright law. And even assuming that there is identical code in the Linux kernel and Unix, and assuming that the Unix code hasn't been freely licensed for us to use in the Linux kernel, that may indicate that there's been an infringement of copyright, but it doesn't necessarily indicate that there has been. Couple of reasons for that. Firstly, simple functions that can only be written in one way can't really have copyright protection. Like, if there's only one way you can write something, then you can't stop someone else from writing it in the same way, even if it is sort of copied. So an example of that is these BSD header files that they've been complaining about. I mean, Linus has said, yeah, that looks a lot similar to yours, but I wrote it myself, and how else would you have expected me to write it? It's just a coincidence. And in fact, some code may even be so simple that it doesn't attract copyright protection to begin with. If something is just trivial, then there's no copyright protection in it anyway. So the PowerPoint slides may be the same, doesn't necessarily mean there's been a copyright infringement. Okay, that's copyright. It protects the expression of ideas. It doesn't actually protect the ideas themselves. It's like a book. If you copy the ideas in a book, but give them new names and new settings and stuff like that, as long as you're not copying the words, that's normally okay. And it's the same with software. Patents. I'll skip to trade secrets first, and then I'll go back to patents. Trade secrets are unlike copyright law in that they can protect ideas rather than just the expression of the ideas. And trade secrets law has been developed by judges over hundreds of years. It's not actually written down in a statute book. It basically says if you've been given information in confidence, then you have to respect that confidence. And sometimes, as in IBM's case, the trade secrets obligation has a contract lying behind it that says we're going to keep this confidential, but it doesn't have to. Even if you don't have a contract, you can still have a duty of confidentiality under trade secrets law. And so it's got an advantage. It's got advantages and disadvantages over other forms of protection. The advantage is, main advantage, like I say, is that it can protect ideas rather than just the expression of ideas. The main disadvantage, I guess, is that unlike copyright protection, the intellectual property owner can lose the protection that they've got if they allow their trade secrets to become known to the public. So you've got to keep it confidential if you want it to remain confidential. Patents are similar to a statutory form of trade secrets rights. I guess there are two main differences. One of them is that patents are only available to protect new and innovative products and processes, not just any secret information. They've got to be innovative. And second, the second difference is that patents prevent the public at large from making use of the information, rather than just preventing the particular people who received the information in secret. And it doesn't matter if the information is known to the public, the obligation still remains to not infringe the patent rights. So that's the main difference there. In Australia, patents last for 20 years, or sometimes 8 years, depending on what type they are. And although that's a long time, it's obviously less than copyright, and so we do have copyright protection still over the Unix code, but not patent protection over all of it, yeah? Well, ordinary patents are 8 years, and then there's a form of lesser patents in Australia that you can get without having to go through the same amount of red tape, and that lasts for 8 years. But if you go for a full patent, whether it's for software or not, you get 20 years. It didn't used to be that you could get patents for software, but over the last few years, it's become clear that you can, and so it's exploded, and there's patents being granted all over the place, here and America and to some extent in Europe. And so I won't go into that because that's another whole kettle of fish, but software patents, obviously, there's a bit of controversy about them, to put it mildly. The advantage of patents, the main advantage of patents, is that it stops people from using the intellectual property even accidentally. I mean, you can infringe a patent accidentally, and that's the big difference. And the only real disadvantage of patents for the intellectual property owner is that they're costly, they take time, and you've got to take out patents separately in every country of the world that you want to have protection, unlike copyright, which is pretty much international automatically. So those are the disadvantages of patents, but there are some big advantages there as well in protecting the ideas behind the software. The final form of intellectual property protection, which I'm not really going to go into, is trademarks. That's not so relevant. It's slightly relevant in that SCO doesn't actually own the trademark Unix. That's owned by the Open Group, and so they're actually... the rights they do have aren't the complete rights to Unix. It's bits and pieces here and there, pretty much, and not including the name. So that's... Now that we've got a bit of background about the facts of the SCO case and the basics of intellectual property law, we're in a better position to assess the vulnerabilities of the Linux kernel and other open source software to attack by companies like SCO. And some of the issues that arise out of the facts of the IBM case in particular are these. When are you allowed to copy? Okay, I've indicated already that there's several cases in which you are allowed to copy stuff. One of them is if the software has entered the public domain. This will happen automatically when the copyright expires, although, like I've said, that's quite a long time. It's like 50 years, and it's 70 years in America, but 50 years here. You can place software into the public domain deliberately if you sort of abandon your copyright or if you specifically license it into the public domain. So that has happened. And, of course, the whole open source movement, to some extent, relies on public domain software. The other instance in which you can copy software is when the copying isn't a substantial part. Now, this phrase "substantial part" is something that lawyers make lots of money out of. It's got a qualitative and a quantitative meaning. So that, in other words, a small but vital fragment of code might be protected by copyright, whereas a longer but less important section of code might not be. So if you want to copy something and you're saying that it's not a substantial part, it's good to have a strong knowledge of the legal background to that phrase, or get legal advice from a lawyer about it, because it's grey area. The other thing you can do, as I've mentioned, is where there's a trivial copying, where you're copying something that is so trivial that there's only one way to write it. So, like, for example, a Hello World program or script, there's only really one way you can write that, and so you can copy that. It doesn't even fall subject to copyright law. And that would apply to comments as well, code or comments, because they're not treated as a literary work if they're just trivial. And they probably wouldn't enjoy trade secret protection either if they're trivial. Subject to, unless you've actually specifically agreed in a contract that you were going to protect these trivial secrets. Okay, another instance in which you can copy is where the copying is non-literal. So if there's nothing to prevent you from re-engineering the functionality of a copyright program, at least there's nothing in copyright law to prevent you from doing so. There may be something in patent law that does, but yeah, re-engineering is fine. And of course, that's what the GNU project was all about originally, just creating a Unix that was better, that was not Unix, that was better than Unix. And in Australia, you've also got the benefit of a provision of the Copyright Act, which allows you to copy, including decompilation and reverse engineering, if you want to create an interoperable product. So if that's what you're specifically doing, if you're wanting to create an interoperable program, then you're allowed to copy the original program for that purpose. That's in Australia only. Now, it's sort of difficult to say whether, if there has been copying into the Linux kernel, whether it would fall into any of these categories. There's probably a good chance that it does. I mean, if it's something like the PowerPoint slides that we've seen, it probably does fall into one or more of these categories. We can't rule that out, but we can't rule it in. We don't really know enough yet. We might know more on the 23rd of January. Excuse me. Okay. So that's when you are allowed to copy, but on the other hand, the fact that you didn't copy any code doesn't necessarily clear you. I mean, you can commit a breach of intellectual property rights without copying any code, and there's three cases that I'm going to go through in which you can still be liable for code that you have written yourself. The first one is if a trade secret covers the code. In IBM's case, the fact that it was working on two Unix-like operating systems at the same time, that was always a danger. I mean, it wasn't a danger that IBM ignored. They knew about it, and they took steps to deal with it. But for smaller developers, it can be difficult to protect yourself from being infected by confidential information if you're trying to work on two projects at once. So trade secrets are a difficulty. Likewise, patents. If the technology's been patented, it's even more difficult because you don't have to knowingly take on a duty of confidence. It can apply to you whether or not you know about the patent existing. You have to honour patents that you may not have even heard of. And the third one is if you create a derivative work of someone else's software. Now, this normally, you might think a derivative work is something like a patch or a fork of some code, but it actually goes beyond that. It can include something like a library that plugs into someone else's code, or a plugin or something like that. That can still be a derivative work. And this is a really grey area, and I haven't got a slide about this, but I'd just like to go into a bit more on this whole notion of derivative works. The question of what is and what isn't a derivative work is probably the biggest unanswered question that we have in copyright law of computer software. There isn't a clear dividing line. It's in other cases, like when you're creating an adaptation of a play or a song or a movie or a translation or an abridgment or something like that, it's clear what is and what isn't a derivative work, but less so with software. And there's a couple of extremes. The Free Software Foundation is at one extreme, and they'll say that you create a derivative work of GPL code simply by linking to that code, even if it's even if the linking is dynamic rather than static. In other words, the GPL code is accessed at runtime from a separate library file. They say that's still creating a derivative work. So that's one extreme. The other extreme is to say that neither static nor dynamic linking creates derivative work because the original code isn't actually being touched. It's not actually making any modifications to that when it's just referenced or accessed through an API or something. So there's no derivative work created. And the true position, we don't know, but it's probably somewhere in between. Probably a program that dynamically links to a library doesn't, in my opinion, doesn't create a derivative work of that library. But on the other hand, a program that If it statically links in, it probably does. But if it just interfaces with or interoperates with the software using an API or some higher level interface, particularly a higher level interface, then it's probably not going to be creating a derivative work for the purposes of copyright law. But this is, like I say, it's a grey area. Recently, Linus has been talking about this last month on the kernel mailing list. Someone asked, okay, what about kernel modules? Are binary-only kernel modules okay? Presumably they are, because there's lots of them around. And he said, well, in my opinion, it sort of depends on whether the module plays with fundamental Linux behavior. If it plays with fundamental Linux behavior, then it is derivative. If it doesn't, then, and if it is derivative, of course, you can't have a binary-only module because the kernel is under GPL. But if it doesn't play with fundamental Linux behavior, then it's fine, you can have a binary-only module. And Linus may well be right. We just really don't know, though, because the question hasn't been considered by a court. But I think he's on the right track anyway. I think it's probably something like that. Anyway, relating this back to the SCO case, IBM developed a whole bunch of stuff that extended the original Unix code in AIX. And so did that or did that not create a derived or a derivative work? And in the case of something like JFS, which I alluded to earlier, which is a journaling file system that IBM created, I think that that's pretty clearly not a derivative work because, well, for starters, the version that was ported over to Linux was actually developed by IBM for OS 2. Admittedly, they did also create an earlier version for AIX, but it's kind of independent of the operating system. I mean, it's a file system. It's not part of the operating system in the same way as even a kernel module would be. So I think to call that a derived work is a bit of a stretch. Yes? Yeah, that's the other thing. Sometimes SCO or others will say, oh, look, this is our trade secret, but in fact you've got to look at, is it their trade secret or did they get it from someone else? Because they can only protect their own secrets. They can't protect other people's secrets. You know, that's for the other people to protect. So, and particularly if they weren't secret at all. If they were in the public domain, then there's no question of it being a trade secret, because that destroys a trade secret if it's been in the public domain. So, okay, these are the issues. Now, what do we do to protect ourselves against these issues? Well, the open source community has actually been quite lucky, I think, to not have suffered an attack like what SCO has brought sooner. Possibly one of the reasons for that is that the open source community generally doesn't have very deep pockets to satisfy a court judgment, so there's not much point in suing open source developers. And also the fact that a lot of open source software, there's no one obvious to sue. Like in the case of the Linux kernel, there's thousands of copyright owners, and the question is, who do you actually sue? So we have been lucky, but so although this is the first significant legal attack that we've had to suffer, I don't think it's going to be the last one. I think we do have to acknowledge that there are problems out there. Just taking an example, in the Linux kernel, there's undoubtedly patent infringements there. I mean, there's no question that there are. And probably the patents that are being infringed are held by people like IBM, ironically. But we are lucky that there's a lot of goodwill out there in the community and that there hasn't been a concerted attack on the kernel for patent infringements or anything like that. And it's not just the Linux kernel that's had that good fortune. Even proprietary projects out there undoubtedly infringe patents but aren't being attacked on that basis. So. But we do have to look hard at what lessons we have to learn from the SCO case if we're going to protect ourselves against future litigation of this type. And there's several ways that we can try to protect ourselves. The Chinese walls, what that actually means is for those who wish to work on proprietary projects and open source projects at the same time, a Chinese wall is like an invisible barrier that goes through the middle of a company that tries to protect each side from the confidential information of the other side. So it's just like a barrier to stop confidential information getting through. And that's what IBM claims to have done between its AIX developers and its Linux developers. Now, will this wash? We don't know for sure, but I think if it's been done properly, it can wash. It's a risk, but IBM is not stupid. And I think if you're a smaller developer, you've got to sort of emulate what IBM's done in that respect. If you're going to take on the risk at all, you've got to make sure that there is a real separation there so that confidential information can't flow through. I think you don't want to have to face that sort of argument in court if you can avoid it. So ideally, don't work on proprietary and open source projects that are in the same field at the same time, because if you do, you're asking for the argument to be made against you that you've allowed confidential information to pass through. And a Chinese wall is not the best solution. The best solution is just don't put yourself in that position to begin with. Okay, the next thing we do, it may sound mercenary, but I think the best protection for an open source project against liability is to make sure that the developers are the ones who have the liability on their shoulders. And really, I mean, that's only sensible because the developers are the ones who can have the best idea of whether their code is contaminated or not. You know, they're the ones who are writing it. They're the ones who are in the best position to check it for intellectual property infringements. So what you can do as the leader of an open source project to ensure the cleanliness of the code that's contributed, you should get them to, you get the developers to agree in writing that all the code that they do contribute has either been written by them or has been taken from a source that's in the public domain or has compatible license terms. And if they do take some code from another source, you need to document that, put it in a register, say this is when we took it. And this is the license under which we've taken it. Yes? Well, I mean, whether you actually ask them for an indemnity or not is a bit of a judgment call, because these people often are doing this for free and they don't want to have to sign an indemnity saying, yes, you can sell my house if you get sued. So, yeah, that's a judgment call. I think you're not necessarily getting them to sign an indemnity, you're just getting them to sign on the dotted line so they take it seriously. Whether it actually contains a legal indemnity in there, maybe that's going too far. It really depends on the project, but often that will be going too far and it'll scare people away. Obviously, you don't want to scare people away. Yeah? Defamation, no. Probably not, because anything that's said in the course of court proceedings is protected. But yeah, if you've paid license fees and it subsequently turns out that they didn't own what they were purporting to license to you, I mean, I haven't seen the terms of their license agreement, but I would imagine that you could have a claim for a refund, yeah. Yeah, it's not so much defamation, but I think that is exactly where Open Source Victoria is coming from in their complaint to the ACCC. They're saying that SCO is engaging in misleading and deceptive conduct. I think that's pretty much where you're coming from, yeah. So that's an argument, yeah. So it's not going to, you know, even if SCO, SCO is not going to win, but no matter how SCO... No matter how SCO comes out of this, it's not going to go away on the 23rd of February, or 11th of April, sorry, 2005. Yes, one more question for now, yep. I mean, they can require corrective advertising, that sort of thing. Maybe a full-page ad in The Australian saying, there's no problem that we can prove with the Linux kernel. As far as we can prove, you're entitled to keep on using it, something like that. I don't know. I'm not involved in that. I haven't really spoken to the Open Source Victoria people about that. The other thing that you should do with your developers is get clearance from their employer if they are employed by someone else on writing software. Should get clearance from their employer to acknowledge any non-disclosure agreement or any confidentiality duty that they may have, and get clearance to allow them to work on your project. And examples of these kinds of agreements, examples of these kinds of agreements and acknowledgements and stuff like that can be found in some of the larger open source projects, such as the GNU project and Mozilla and OpenOffice.org. So you're really reducing your risk of liability if you do get them to sign something, just to acknowledge that they do have obligations there. And, you know, you've got to make a judgment call over whether you're going to scare them away or whether you're going to actually give yourself a bit of protection against liability on your own account, because you're the leader of this project and you're the obvious person to sue. Yes? Go, you mean? Yeah, certainly. There's not a requirement for one country, for Australia, to follow decisions of the United States. It is going to be persuasive if the United States court makes a finding of law, not so much a finding of fact, but if they make a finding of law, then that's not going to be completely irrelevant in Australia, but it's going to be largely irrelevant because particularly our High Court, they don't take too much notice of what any other country does. It's got some... If it was a line ball decision, it might make a difference, but it's not going to be a line ball decision, so I don't think that it's going to make that much difference. The other thing that we can do to protect ourselves is to choose the right license. And you're going to want to look at a license that actually gives you some protection against contributors who introduce patented technologies into the project. And one of the best licenses in that respect is the Mozilla public license, which has got a clause 8.2, which says, amongst other things, that if a licensee of software, that is, if a user of your software brings a patent claim against any developer or contributor, then unless they can agree with the developer and contributor on a reasonable fee for their own use of the software, then they will have their license to use the software terminated and their right to damages will be limited. So it doesn't stop them from suing you for patent infringement, but it does mean that if you sue us, you have to take account of the value that you've obtained from our software. So in the case of SCO, that would come back to scope quite nicely. And the GPL has also got a bit of a provision there in clause 7, which says that if there's anything, including a patent, that would stop you from freely distributing the software, then you're not allowed to distribute it at all. So those are licenses that have considered the question of patents to some degree. I think the Mozilla one's better than the GPL, but there are some licenses which just ignore it completely, like the BSD license and the artistic license don't really have much to say about patents. So you should look at a license that does consider patents. And speaking of patents, what you should do, because you can infringe a patent without realising it, you've got to reduce your ignorance about what patents are out there, because ignorance is no excuse. And that means reading. You can actually search the patent specifications because they're all public. You can do that online in the case of Australian patents. You aren't able to directly make use of what you've read in the sense of implementing it, but you are allowed to make use of it in the sense of knowing how to step around a particular patent. And the other thing that you can do, if there's no way of stepping around it, you can contact the patent owner and say, look, are you willing to give us a royalty-free license for this patent that is compatible with our open source licensing terms? And a lot of the time they might say yes. So that's the other thing you can do. It's not the end of the world if you do run up against a patent. But yeah, check the literature, check competitive products. Like if you've got a proprietary product that is in the same field as what you're doing, have a read of it and see if it mentions any patents there, and that will give you a clue about where to look. And also just journal articles and wherever are a good place to look as well. Yes? Yeah. Well, if you've got money, and of course a lot of open source projects don't have money, but if you do have money, you get a lawyer to do it for you or a patent attorney and pay them, and if they're wrong, then you sue them. But if you don't have money, no, I mean, there's not really, I mean, if you get contacted by someone and they say, hey, you're infringing our patent, then if you can show that you have gone through a procedure, then they're unlikely to, you know, hit you over the head about it. They're going to want to resolve it with you and maybe license it to you, or else just ask you to change it in a certain way. So, yeah. Yeah, I mean, yeah. There's no magic solution to that, I'm afraid. Do we have another hand up? Yeah. Yep. Yeah. To a lesser extent, our searching, particularly online, is better than what you've got in the US, so it's not quite so bad. The other thing that's an advantage is that you do have to take out patent protection in every country of the world. So if you may be infringing a US patent, and as long as you only distribute it within Australia, that doesn't matter. You're allowed to just say, you know, this is only allowed to be used within Australia. If you are from America, please do not download this. And that will be okay if there's no Australian patent. I think I'll just finish off and then take some more questions because we have sort of run out of time. I mean, there's nothing much more I have to say. I mean, the only other point we have here is the more independent you can make your project from the internals of any software that you're deriving it from or making it interoperable with, the better. So try and plug it in using some high-level API, like for modules or plugins or something like that, or make it a separate library. Don't link in the code at a lower level, and don't try and tinker with the internals too much, because that reduces the risk that you're going to be found of having created a derivative work. So, I mean, SCO's case, it's all bluster. I think it relates more to its ambitions to bolster its stock price or get bought out more than any real belief that it's been wronged by IBM. But I think that it is a wake-up call for us, and it's the kind of thing that could have happened before. We're lucky that it hasn't. To some extent, the damage has already been done. I mean, it's like with the internet, how it used to be all friendly and everything was open, and you know, there was no problems with spam and you know, too much malicious hacking and that sort of thing. So, you know, it's no longer such a friendly place, the open source world. We are going to have to start getting serious and look to, as far as copyright goes, we've got to look to our developers to guarantee the cleanliness of their code, make sure that we don't accidentally taint it by making it a derivative work. As far as trade secrets go, we've got to get clearance from developers and their employers to make sure that if there is any confidential information, they're not prohibited from joining our open source project. As far as patents go, we've got to know the technologies that are out there and either work around them or see if we can obtain a royalty-free license for them. So if we have the discipline to think about these issues, we're not only protecting ourselves from liability, we're also protecting our contributors and our users, more importantly. And although SCO has already shaken the confidence of some people out there, governments and enterprise, you know, have been shaken by this, if we can go back and show them that we're thinking about these issues and that we've improved our processes and procedures, then I think that is going to help the open source development model to survive and thrive in the post-SCO world. So, did we have a question? Yes? Yeah, from what I've heard, the most significant impact of that will be more on copyright law than on patent law, but it's going to be difficult for us to resist, you know, caving into whatever the US asks for, but there's a lot of antagonism out there in the community to dumbing down our system. The US DMCA, which is their Digital Millennium Copyright Act, has got a lot more trouble in it for people like ISPs who are at the moment pretty well protected from copyright infringements on their networks as long as they weren't really responsible for them. And they're going to be in a lot more danger if we turn our legislation into a carbon copy of what the USA has. So I think I haven't really thought through the implications as far as software copyright goes, but so I'd probably have to give that some more thought. But overall, I'm just hopeful that we're not going to wholesale adopt the US approach, because what we've got is actually better than what they've got, I think. Yes. Yeah, I think that's more likely to be called a derivative work. In a way, it's a funny place to draw the dividing line, because it doesn't really matter, in a sense, whether it's statically or dynamically linked. But what I'm trying to mean by that is that if you can show this is something that is quite independent, we can plug it in, we can plug it out, it's only got a few sort of calls that it uses to interface with the other program, that's less likely to be derivative. But the more entangled it is with the software, the more system calls that it uses within the other program, that's going to be more likely to be derivative. So, yes? Yeah, I think there is an argument, to be honest, that they can say this was not released with our authority, and so it wasn't an intentional act. I think, much as I am inclined to mock SCO, I think that there is an argument there, and it may not succeed, but it's definitely an argument. Yeah, that's true as well. The only thing is that it's hard to practically put the genie back in the bottle, and so there's also... the fact that they would have to, if people were keeping on using it, there would be an argument both ways as to whether they, whether this license. Yes, SCO would have to just inform them that it was revoked individually, possibly. That's the kind of argument you'd make. You'd say, well, okay, you've revoked it to these people over here, but I haven't been reading the newspaper and I haven't been reading your website, so I don't know that it's been revoked, so I'm allowed to keep on using it. I think, have we got time for one more question? Yes? Yep. Yeah, when it's the same actual programmer who's working on two projects, that's the most dangerous situation you can be in. It's easier for a company that has got different developers working on the different projects, but when it's the same developer, the best thing to do is to try and get the approval of the person you're working for before, to say, can I work on this project? And if you don't, there's always going to be a risk there, because, you can say, I've deliberately blocked this out of my mind, but how are you going to prove it? So. Okay, if anyone else has questions, I'm free. I'm here for the rest of the conference. I've got some business cards here if you want to grab them, and you can email me as well. So, thank you, people.